I get the sense that the Coast Guard and the state of Alaska and the shipping industry are willing to roll the dice and hope for the best.
A shipping safety advocate sounds the alarm about vessel traffic in the Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Juneau Assembly considers regulating e-cigarettes.
It's renormalizing cigarette smoking in public. Little kids can't distinguish between what's a traditional cigarette and what's an e-cigarette.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Finding the time for physical activity after school, homework, and dinner can be tough, but you can make it a priority to stay healthy as a family. Go for a bike ride, take a walk around the neighborhood, or play a game of basketball with your kids. Get active, get moving, and have fun as a family. Inspire your kids to get out and play 60 minutes every day. For more ways to get physically active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
As the summer Arctic shipping season gets underway, a member of a group that formed after the Selandaing IU ran aground a decade ago is calling for more rescue tugs, monitoring, and risk management measures in the Bering Strait and Unimak Pass. In letters to the Coast Guard, Rick Steiner with the Shipping Safety Partnership says the money to address these concerns could come from the $3.5 billion oil spill liability trust fund the Coast Guard has.
It's used almost exclusively for spill response, but we all know that spill response simply doesn't work. So we're arguing that this fund ought to be broken open and used to charter these rescue tug assets during the summer shipping season through the Arctic. And then they could relocate this tug to the Dutch Harbor Unimak Pass area for the winter, which is where the risk increases down there.
The Coast Guard has no deepwater port north of Dutch Harbor, so it has to deploy its assets north seasonally. It has ramped up its presence there over the past three shipping seasons. Before leaving for his new post in D.C., 17th District Commander Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo visited Dutch Harbor with Senator Mark Begich. Ostebo said the Coast Guard is focused on the Bering Strait and Northern Sea Route. He says response preparation is key, but the U.S. can't govern the Bering Strait.
The Bering Strait is an international strait. Anybody who wants to can go through that. We don't own it. We don't control it. We don't have a toll booth there. We don't manage that. The Northern Sea Route, also an international strait, overseen very heavily by the Russians, obviously. But what I like people to first realize, we don't control this. So all of this is going to happen whether we want to play or not. And our involvement in this, I think, needs to be appropriate for the likelihood of a mishap.
This is a very different Arctic presence for the Coast Guard than what Ed Page remembers from his 30 years of service.
When I was at Coast Guard, we spent no time up there. It's totally off the radar screen.
Page now heads up the Marine Exchange, a Juneau-based vessel tracking organization that has 95 real-time monitoring stations in Alaska. Page says, back in the day, there was none of that.
And if you ask me where the ships were in the Arctic or in Aleutian Islands, I go, well, we'll put a plane up tomorrow, we'll look out the window, and I'll get back to you. Today, the Coast Guard can say, well, I got on my iPhone or my iPad or my desktop computer, I can tell you exactly where the vessels are right now, because through international treaty, International Maritime Organization, has required that all vessels, larger vessels, commercial vessels, have this technology of transponders, much like aircraft have.
The vessel's name, speed, and dimensions are displayed and tracked. Vessels are now required to stay farther offshore. This allows more time to get help if they have engine problems before they run aground. Page says if this system would have been in place when the Selandaing IU had trouble a decade ago, they would have known immediately rather than 19 hours after the vessel lost engines, because it would automatically have triggered an alarm in the operations center. If the vessel doesn't respond, the Marine Exchange notifies the Coast Guard. Page says he appreciates the concerns of Steiner and other environmentalists who want to protect the fragile Arctic ecosystem. But he says although Arctic vessel traffic has increased in the last decade, it's still relatively low compared to other shipping routes. His big concern is with enormous cargo vessels. Ships that are 1,300 feet long, carry thousands of containers, and have 100,000 horsepower engines. If they have trouble in a storm, there's no tug large enough that can help.
Absolutely no tug. It's going to go wherever Mother Nature decides it wants to take that ship. That's a concern I have. You can just watch it unfold because you can't do anything about it. They're so big.
But Rick Steiner insists there's still a lot more that can and should be done, and he's persisting in urging that the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund be reprogrammed to include prevention.
The greatest missing link here is the political will to drive the risk as low as possible. I get the sense that the Coast Guard and the state of Alaska and the shipping industry are willing to roll the dice and hope for the best and just expect that this won't happen on their watch. But what if it does?
Whose ever watch it may be, the system has been evolving and will continue to. The Coast Guard hopes to have a voluntary vessel separation scheme in place through the Bering Strait before long, and while congressional funding for more icebreakers may be nowhere in sight, other ice-hardened vessels are being tried. Ed Page says the Coast Guard has not secured funding from Congress to build a vessel tracking network for Alaska, making the Marine Exchange's monitoring program all the more critical for observing who is transiting the vast and remote waters of the Arctic. Interior miners aren't happy with changes proposed to federal permits for small-scale placer operations that impact water resources, including wetlands. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, dozens attended an Army Corps of Engineers public meeting in Fairbanks last week on the proposals.
Roger Burggraf of Fairbanks has been in the mining business for 40 years and says he's witnessed a regulatory trend that's forcing out mom-and-pop placer operators.
It's a small miner is an endangered species.
Burggraf laments the demise he blames on expanding and increasingly complex environmental regulations and paperwork.
You know, they are required to do the same thing that the big mining companies do, and they don't have the resources or the technical ability to fill out permits.
Burggraf points to legal interpretations of the Clean Water Act that have expanded the definition of wetlands, resulting in more regulation of mining in wet areas that cover much of the interior. Army Corps of Engineers regulatory specialist Deb McAtee says the proposed permitting system reflects court rulings.
Clean Water Act and all the lawsuits has changed quite a bit over the years, so we're just trying to get the miners back kind of step closer to meeting the regulations.
The proposed new permits cover smaller areas, focus on wetlands, and require more specialized reclamation. Army Corps Project Manager Leslie Tose points to a 2008 mitigation rule that's being rolled into the permit.
So we're hoping that we can work with people to help them just tweak their reclamation a little bit so that they can maybe control their erosion a little better or get back some wetlands on their sites. And they would be very different kind of wetlands than what were there before. We're not asking people to restore black spruce.
Tose says miners would also be required to better document their sites and work with photos. The proposed new permit, which is out for public comment, did not sit well with most miners at the meeting, but Casey Post, who's mined north of Fairbanks for 5 years, expressed mixed feelings.
It's just keeping everything in line with their rules. And no, I don't like all of the rules.
Post attributes some of the negativity about the proposed new permit to misinformation that's been rumored around, but adds wetlands reclamation can be a big deal.
These guys talk about stream diversions. I don't have to do that, but that's like months and months of work where you're not making any money. It's simply expenditures, right?
Post, one of the younger people at the meeting, says he understands the frustration of longtime miners, but considers permits and regulatory compliance just another part of the business.
I've only been at this for 5 years, so I don't have a backpack full of expectations. And so I'm just trying to play by their rules.
Those rules are blamed by old-timers like Roger Burggraf for quashing the kind of pioneering people he credits with making Alaska what it is today.
The small miner that had the enterprising spirit to come in and build a country. And that's being destroyed by the federal government now.
Burgraff does not blame the Army Corps of Engineers, which he says is trying to craft a workable placer permit, but has to meet constraints coming from above. The Corps' TOS is optimistic despite initial negative sentiment.
Very often they're kind of cranky when they first start talking to us, and they have a lot of, there's a lot of words that are red herring words that they'll react to. And once we sit down and start talking to them, we can say, well, our intention wasn't this. Maybe we used the wrong word. What we're really hoping for is this, and how can we get there?
TOS says timing of the proposed permit rollout is not ideal because miners are busy during the summer. She says the public comment period will be extended to provide more off-season time for feedback. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Conservation groups are asking for endangered species protection for yellow cedar trees in Alaska. The trees have been dying off in portions of Southeast over the past century. Scientists say it's likely due to a warming climate and lack of snow cover for vulnerable roots. The groups say logging also poses a threat to the cedar trees on the Tongass National Forest. Kirsten Lippman is a biologist with the Center for Biological Diversity and says the cedar decline in Southeast Alaska is drastic.
The reason we're doing this now is we're seeing, especially in Alaska, the timber industry is targeting the remaining living cedar. It's kind of like when the buffalo were dying out, people would go out and hunt the last buffalo because it was our last chance to get them.
Other petitioners are the Boat Company, Greenpeace, and the Greater Southeast Alaska Conservation Community. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it will review the petition to determine whether the species status deserves further review. That finding is supposed to take about 90 days. There's only one plant in Alaska on the endangered species list. That's the Aleutian shield fern, which is found on Adak Island. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating World Refugee Day in Anchorage.
Policy say you go to call Alaska very far, and then I come here, it's nice.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Tribal and federal officials say the plan to build a regional hospital in Unalaska is closer than ever to reality. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
For most locals, the idea of a full-size hospital in Unalaska has always been little more than a pipe dream. But not for Tom Robinson of the Kawalungan tribe. He's been trying to make the hospital happen for more than 5 years.
We noticed that we really needed a medical facility in Unalaska. And with the course of events of losing some of our elders a couple years ago, the Key Tribe really pressed the issue.
They teamed up with their tribal health provider, the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, to put new energy into lobbying for a hospital. Now, the APIA's Primary Care Services Administrator, Jessica Matarukovishnikov, says that work is paying off.
It is definitely the closest we've been in all the years since we started the process in 2008.
That's thanks in part to Alaska Senator Mark Begich. He's lobbying for up to about $100 million in federal funds for the project. Matarukovishnikov says the APIA would be happy to see even part of that sum. They're asking local groups to chip in, too.
They're more likely to see and pass and give money based on support from the community.
That includes more than just tribal stakeholders. The hospital will be designed to serve everyone in the region, locals, veterans, fishermen and other industry workers, and tribe members. So the APIA is casting a wide net to look for funding. Meanwhile, other details of the project are still coming together. There's no location for the hospital in Unalaska yet, and housing for its 200 or so expected employees is still up in the air. In terms of services, Matarukovishnikov couldn't say yet how many beds the hospital would have, but she says it should offer a 24-hour emergency room, basic surgeries, and a range of specialists. She's also hoping they can provide prenatal and maternity care. That would mean expectant moms wouldn't have to spend weeks in Anchorage when it was time to give birth.
I mean, that would be something of a major accomplishment.
For outpatient services, the new facility would absorb Unalaska's two existing clinics, the APIA's Unalaska Wellness Center and the Illilook Family and Health Services Community Clinic. IFHS Director Eileen Conlin-Scott expects to move all her staff, services, and grant funding over to the new hospital. The clinic's current building might become an administrative office. Scott says the merger would be a big step forward.
We have people that don't get health care services because they can't afford to fly off the island. You know, so we're trying to bring consultants to the island at least to get an initial checkup by a specialist, but to have some of these specialists here the whole time, it's much better for our community.
For Tom Robinson of the Kowalungan Tribe, flying to Anchorage for routine care has been the norm for far too long.
You look at what the locals in the region have to go through to get primary care, it's very tough. And this will also serve our elder. Can you imagine the stress that our elder have to go through to travel to get primary care?
Robinson says the hospital would serve about 2,000 tribal members and as many as 10,000 Aleutian Pribilof and Southwest residents in total. It would also make good on a decades-old loss by replacing the native hospital destroyed in Unalaska during World War II.
Our hospital was bombed by the Japanese and then burnt down by the military. And thereafter, it was never rebuilt. And really, there wasn't any effort put back into, or no, there wasn't the initiative to have it rebuilt until recently.
Even if everything goes according to plan, Unalaska won't see its new hospital until about 2018. Robinson is confident it's going to happen. The tribe has already started doing community outreach in Unalaska. They're planning on more as they start looking at locations for the hospital later this year. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The Juneau Assembly is considering a ban on e-cigarette vapors in nearly all indoor public spaces. The local chapter of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence led the push at an assembly committee meeting yesterday. A council representative argued that the new tobacco alternative is being marketed to youth and misrepresented as harmless. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has more.
E-cigarettes are trending, and that makes Kristen Cox very concerned.
So e-cigarettes, they're new, they're blue, but will they still kill you?
Cox is a naturopathic doctor and the Tobacco Prevention Program Coordinator for Juneau's branch of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. She didn't exactly say yes. The research world is playing catch-up with the products as more parties enter the marketplace and innovate. But Cox did warn that the widespread claims that e-cigarette vapors are harmless and an effective way to help someone quit smoking are both scientifically unproven and maybe entirely wrong. Researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, recently published a review of 84 e-cigarette studies in a peer-reviewed journal of the American Heart Association. They found a chaotic marketplace filled with a range of unsubstantiated claims and quality control issues with the products themselves. Results of trials comparing the toxicity of various e-cigarette vapors to traditional tobacco smoke varied wildly. For example, one study of a particular brand discovered toxic metals at levels higher than in regular cigarette smoke, likely coming from the e-cigarette's metal heating elements. Other studies bore out claims that e-cigarette vapors were less harmful than tobacco smoke, but not harmless.
You know, middle school kids think they're harmless. They're using these devices, they think they're really harmless, that there's harmless water vapor is what they're inhaling, and that's not the case.
Cox says big tobacco companies have been pumping a lot of money into buying e-cigarette companies and beefing up their advertising campaigns with youths in mind. E-cigarette juice, vaping liquid, or e-liquid is being made in candy and fruit flavors. Cox says it's an initiation tool to introduce youths to nicotine addiction and tobacco use.
This is a really, really serious issue. It's renormalizing cigarette smoking in public. Little kids can't distinguish between what's a traditional cigarette and what's an e-cigarette.
Under the ordinance the Assembly is considering, the vapors would be treated the same as tobacco smoke, which Juneau banned from virtually all indoor public spaces in 2008. If the Assembly adopts the ordinance, Cox says,
it's going to signal to people that those are dangerous, they're not harmless.
A few blocks away from City Hall, Robert Rodman has sold e-cigarette products for about a year in his store, Percy's Liquor. He's more or less indifferent about the possible ban.
I don't think it's a huge issue one way or the other.
Rodman keeps an e-cigarette for himself in the shop to demonstrate how it's used. His looks like a fat pen. One end houses a battery and heating element. The other end has a vial with the e-liquid. The liquid he's using has no nicotine.
Yeah, I'm not a smoker. So I have no interest in nicotine.
Then Rodman used one of the lines that Cox was worried about.
It's just flavored water, basically. So, you know, in that case, you know, there's no harm.
In fact, the base in most e-liquids is a common food additive the Food and Drug Administration says is safe to eat, though researchers warn drawing it into your lungs as an aerosol isn't the same and can cause respiratory problems. Rodman pushed a button and breathed in. A moment later, he puffed out wisps of a white, scented vapor that hung in the air for a few moments before dissipating.
You're not really inhaling it, so I don't know, it's just a pleasurable sensation. You know, you get a little bit of mouthfeel with it, you know, in your throat. So, and with the flavors, you know, you get some taste. I mean, this is coffee. You know, it's kind of a cool thing.
The Assembly will hold a public hearing on the e-cigarette vapor ordinance at its next meeting, June 30th. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
After months of planning and studying the numbers, state and federal managers okayed the first 6-inch drift gillnet opening today on the most densely populated stretch of the Kuskokwim River. The fishing will be aimed at chum and sockeye salmon, but managers are moving cautiously to make sure enough king salmon make it to spawning grounds. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
No one will know for sure until well after the king salmon have stopped running, but State Kuskokwim Area Management Biologist Aaron Potter says the early conservation measures seem to have successfully moved king salmon past many of the river's 2,000 subsistence households.
We feel pretty comfortable with making the call that we have enough fish upriver to meet at least the lower end of the goal. We want to ensure that those fish do make it to the spawning grounds, so we're going to continue to tread lightly and implement the Chinook conservation while we're providing additional opportunity.
After not meeting escapement in 2 of the past 4 years, the priority this year is hitting the midpoint of the river's escapement goal, about 85,000 fish. 2014 was expected to be a weak run between 71 and 117,000 kings. Nobody has been allowed to fish for kings since May 20th, but managers briefly opened a portion of the lower river to fishing for other salmon species last week. Managers say Friday evening's 4-hour opening brought out just under 200 boats. They estimate that of 11,000 salmon caught, about 670 were king salmon. With many more boats anticipated out of Bethel and nearby communities, federal in-season manager Brian McCaffrey says kings will be caught in the 6-inch, 25-fathom nets.
I would anticipate this next opening that there will be some thousands of kings taken among all the boats. But given where we are in the run, we're pretty confident that the run can accommodate that, given how many fish have already gone by.
Managers don't have a great estimate of how many boats will drop their nets at 10 a.m. Tuesday, but Potter says fishermen will be out in force.
The 130 4-inch whitefish nets, it was probably going to pale in comparison to what we're going to see.
By restricting nets to 25 fathoms instead of the usual 50, managers can further fine-tune the amount of harvest. The latest data from the Bethel test fishery on Sunday shows that the chum and sockeye ratio to king salmon is about 9 to 1. Potter will attempt to get a rough sketch of the harvest Tuesday morning and see how many kings were caught in nets before setting the next opening.
I do expect more openings this week. We're looking for something, again, a little bit later on in the week. As we continue to roll opportunity up the river and continue to liberalize opportunity down this lower section.
In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Anchorage residents gathered at Mountain View Lions Park on Friday to celebrate World Refugee Day. The day honors people who have fled their home country, often because of war or ethnic persecution. About 120 refugees are resettled in Anchorage every year as part of a national program. KSKA's Ann Hillman attended the festivities and talked to people about their lives in Alaska.
Netra Dakal dances to music from his home country of Bhutan. The song tells a story familiar to his parents, a boy who left his village and misses his home. Dakal's family was forced to leave Bhutan when he was 3 years old.
Bhutan government said that you were Nepali, because you eat Nepali, you drink Nepali, you speak Nepali, you wear Nepali dress, everything, and you are in Bhutan, so you should go to Nepal. And we went there, you know, they forced us to leave Bhutan, so we went to Nepal. But Nepal government said, you came from Bhutan, so you are not Nepali citizen, you should go back to Bhutan.
The family lived in a refugee camp in Nepal for 18 years. Dakal says they couldn't work and didn't have access to things like radios, electricity, or cars. organizations donated food, schools, and healthcare for the camp of 140,000 people. In 2010, they were finally relocated to Alaska.
In the beginning, it was a little hard because of English problem. You know, it was hard to communicate with people, go shopping, travel from place to place.
But now Dakal has earned his GED and is teaching English as a second language. Abdi Karim Mohammed arrived in Anchorage from a refugee camp in Kenya in 2011. He's originally from Somalia. When he learned he was moving to Alaska, he says people warned him.
Police say you go to call Alaska very far. And then I come here, I live. It's nice, winter and summer.
Mohammed says he never wants to go back to live in East Africa.
No, I'm living here, America. I like it so much.
He shares his enthusiasm with other Somali refugees by greeting them as soon as they arrive in the airport. Catholic Social Services Refugee Assistance Program named him one of their volunteers of the year. But many refugees pointed out that the celebration also recognizes nearly 17 million people worldwide who were still refugees. And with the new conflicts in Iraq, Ukraine, and South Sudan, the numbers are rising. Peter Rahm's family fled southern Sudan into Ethiopia before he was born. He resettled in the United States 13 years ago.
I would say thank you for God bring me here to America. And also I feel bad what happened in my country now. And that people, a lot of people, they are in rural area, remote area. Yeah, they are very difficult.
Rahm says people there can easily get sick from malaria or diarrhea. Now, because of the war, it's hard for them to get money or food, too. Rahm has returned a few times on mission trips to try to help, but he says his home is now the United States. The U.S. Office of Refugee Resettlement reports that more than 58,000 refugees were accepted into the country in the fiscal year 2012. Only a small number can be resettled in Anchorage because of housing constraints. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Annie Ropeek and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.